I'm Mary Nightingale. Welcome to the Piper Podcast, How I Grew My Brand, where I talk to successful founders about how they made it, where the big idea came from, how they funded it, how they developed it, and in some cases went on to sell it. What were the pitfalls along the road to the status of brand legend, and what does success really feel like? Today, I'm talking to Kate Bursky, founder with her husband, Michał, of the specialist hair care brand Curlsmith, selling what they describe as gourmet products for textured hair, whether it's wavy, curly or coily. Launched in 2018, the couple sold and exited the business in 2022 for $150 million. So that is, I think we can all agree, a pretty meteoric rise by any standard. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. I mean, is that how it feels? Does it feel like it was meteoric?
I know, I'm not sure I'd ever use the word meteoric. Probably intense and crazy and everything everywhere all at once. It's all strange.
And we're just coming up for the first anniversary of when you exited, when you sold.
Yeah, on the weekend, it was literally the one-year anniversary of our exit, which has just flown by. But it feels quite full circle because actually our first office, following on from Costa Coffee and Ealing, was just down the road from here. So it feels very, I think it'll be quite cathartic to talk to you about this today.
Oh, good, good. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm just wondering, you know, when you're talking about it having been very intense and incredibly busy and all-encompassing, what did it feel like to suddenly step away?
It was strange because this business kind of was our whole life. It dominated our life for sort of 5-6 years. And we were lucky enough, you know, many exits involve founders staying on for several years in some capacity. And we were lucky enough to find a deal. We sold to Helen of Troy in the US, and we were able to walk away completely. So it was the most sudden exit of any business I've ever, you know, been involved in. You know, there was not, you know, any sort of goodbyes or handovers. It was just kind of we were gone. So it did feel very abrupt, but it was also a relief after that.
You say we were lucky enough to be able to step away entirely, but in some ways I wonder whether that would have been very difficult and kind of almost like heart-wrenching in a way.
Yeah, people always say this to us. And I think, you know, we, from the very early days, we knew that this was not going to be for the rest of our lives. We love the early stages, the setup, the scrappiness, the kind of creative part. And as soon as the business grows and becomes something different, more corporate, some of that spark, you know, gets lost a little bit. So I think we knew it was time for us to kind of leave it in the capable hands of our team and of Helen of Troy to really grow it beyond that. So there was a little bit of sadness. I mean, I'm very emotional, and of course there were tears on the day, and I was sad to leave the team. But yeah, I think overwhelmingly we knew it was the right time for us to step away.
All right. Well, we will talk more about that in a minute. But first of all, let's go right back to the beginning of Curlsmith. Where did the idea come from?
It was a couple of things, really. So, as you said, Curlsmith is a premium performance hair care brand specifically designed to enhance naturally curly and wavy hair. And the idea for that came from a couple of different areas, really. So Michał and I, so I set the business up with my husband, Michał. And at the time, he was working in sort of corporate beauty. So his background is L'Oreal, Unilever, P&G, you know, the big beauty brands in the world. And I was working in consulting for M&C Saatchi Clear at that time. And I was working with a lot of beauty and personal care brands. And so we're working with all these kind of big brands and increasingly realizing that there were huge sort of segments of the population that were being underserved. And one of them that kept coming up time and time again over the years was people with curly and wavy hair. At the time, beauty brands almost felt like curly and wavy hair was a niche. But actually, in reality, about 70-80% of us have some kind of hair texture, whether it's wavy, curly, kinky, coily, whatever it is. So it isn't a niche, but it was being ignored. I think the year we started thinking about this, around about 2017, only about 1% of the launches in hair care were for textured hair. But if 70-80% of women have that hair texture, that feels like a massive gap. So we kind of had it in our mind. And it would almost be, when I was consulting, there would almost be jokes amongst my sort of client companies I was working for about, oh, imagine if we, for example, made a hairdryer for curly hair. How funny, how niche.
And actually, was just curly hair regarded as a kind of problem then that needed to be solved in a way?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. At the time, if you think about it, you couldn't turn on the television and see women with curly hair. readily, or open a magazine and see women with curly or wavy hair. In fact, you know, think about, you know, insert mainstream brand here. Often women with curly hair would be the before picture. Mm. And then suddenly they would use, you know, X shampoo and their hair would be sleek and straight and shiny. So women with textured hair were constantly being told they needed to iron out, literally, their natural hair texture. And we didn't really feel that that was right. And we also knew there were a whole group of women that had textured hair that didn't know about it. You know, we always used to say, frizz is not a hair type. If you have frizzy hair, that is curl potential. You know, you can do a lot to enhance the natural texture and really love the hair you have. There's no such thing as bad hair, only sort of the wrong hair care. So all of that was going on kind of professionally, and all of those insights and that kind of thing. And then I guess when it really became a thing was when it got personal. So we were at that age in our sort of early 30s where friends and family started having children. My nieces were born. They have very, very curly hair, but their mum has very straight hair. And she would always be on the phone saying, guys, you know, what do I do? How do I manage this hair? It's so different to mine. And so we started looking into products that were available. We'd, you know, go into shops and look online, and what we found is there was very little available that we could help my sister-in-law and then, you know, later on my goddaughter with. You know, you'd walk into Boots at that time in the UK and there'd be a very small, if you were lucky, shelf of curly hair products, and they might have a specific type of person on the front of them. They'd be targeted at a specific hair type or a specific group, and others would be alienated by that. Or there would be a mainstream hair brand with a sideline in kind of curly or frizzy hair. But they weren't really specialists, and actually curly and wavy hair needs very different type of care to straight hair. So they weren't really catering for it. And then there were this other group of sort of salon brands where you could get some quite good results, but those products were packed full with things that are actually quite bad for hair. So silicones, sulfates, parabens, drying alcohols, things that might, you know, make your hair look great the first time you use it, but over time would be damaging the health of your hair. So we knew there was an opportunity to basically look into creating something that was really high performing, but was not compromising the health of your hair. But, you know, nonetheless, it was still kind of an idea for a long time, a year or more. And we kind of started off just sharing content, creating content, basically. So we were very much a kind of Instagram native brand around about 2017, 2018. We launched an Instagram page and just started sharing content, tips, tricks.
We're just talking about curly or
just talking about curly hair. Yeah. So we started sharing kind of recipes. What we noticed is because curly girls couldn't find the products that were both effective and really nourishing for their hair, they'd start making delicious and lovely smelling hair remedies in their kitchen, putting it on. So we were, you know, sharing recipes about that and, you know, just tips and tricks about how to look after curly hair. We interviewed trichologists, hairdressers who specialised in curly hair, and just started sharing content. And what we found is there was a whole group of people who were underserved by the mass market that just were looking for this kind of education and information. So they kind of started following us. So we quite quickly built up this community of curly and wavy haired followers. And they kind of over time put pressure on us to actually put our money where our mouth was and kind of create the products that didn't yet exist.
But how did you then take that step to create your own products? I mean, how did you fund that? How did it actually happen?
Well, luckily, my expertise is more about branding, marketing, and insight, the kind of creative side. But he's worked quite a lot in products, so bringing products to market. So he had a really good network of, you know, manufacturers and that kind of thing, formulators already. So he was able to, you know, for a very, very small budget, we had a very small amount of seed funding, and we actually launched the whole first line on about £70,000 of seed funding. So really not a lot to get it all off the ground.
So tell me about your background. Are you and Michal entrepreneurs by nature? Were your families entrepreneurial? Is that what you grew up within?
Not exactly. I mean, I would say Michal and I are very, very different. He is a born entrepreneur. He is a born leader and not a follower. He's quite rebellious in the wrong situation, but in the right context, obviously he thrives. So I'd say he was a born entrepreneur, although he had gone down the corporate route, which was, you know, a good grounding for what we ended up doing. His parents are both self-employed. So that was kind of in his DNA that, you know, it was an option to work for yourself. I'm a bit different. My parents were, you know, professionals, teacher and a psychologist, and they never expected me to do anything like this. I think it was all a bit of a surprise for them. So I think Michal was the one who pulled the trigger on this. But I was already self-employed. I was freelancing as a brand consultant. So I already knew how it was to work for myself, and I knew that was for me.
But am I right in saying that you carried on freelancing during the early days of the business? Because you know, money needs to come from somewhere, I guess.
That's it. And I guess that's one of the challenges with being a sort of family business or a husband and wife team. We didn't have a wife at home making money for us, so I had to do that job. So for the first couple of years, I was very much dividing my time between Curlsmith and freelancing in brand consulting, exactly to pay the mortgage and the bills.
Was it important to you to do something together? Was that part of what you aimed to do?
Not really. I kind of ended up falling into it. I think he was the one who really wanted to commit and go for it. But I ended up getting more and more sucked into it quite quickly and just kind of gave in at a certain point. And it was a brilliant business. And it was good to work together. I think it's really nice to see your partner in their kind of being their, sounds cheesy, their best self, you know, in the role they're meant to be in. I think, you know, he'd been in other jobs where he wasn't as happy and fulfilled. And even though running a business, starting a business is much more stressful, it was a lot more fulfilling for him. So I feel like he really found his purpose, and that was really lovely to witness and be part of. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously challenges as well, you know, from the practical to the less practical. But overall, I think it worked really well for us, and we would and will do it again.
Complementary skills, I guess.
Yeah, our skills never kind of competed. We're so different in every way that it worked well.
How quickly did you realise that you had a success on your hands?
I think the game-changing moment was, because we'd been kind of thinking about this idea for a while, and we had this, you know, Instagram account, we had this community. But when we decided to pull the trigger and create the products, it feels now in hindsight fairly quick. We were ambitious from the get-go, and we were having lots of conversations with retailers as well, because they were also looking for products that filled this kind of gap. And we had some really great conversations with Ulta Beauty in the States, and they decided to put us in every door on the same day, which I think that year, and to date, very few brands have ever done. I think it was us and Kylie Beauty or something like that year that went into all doors overnight. And that was a real hockey stick moment for us. Even though we'd been sort of retailing online here and there and mostly in Europe, when we focused on the US and when we went exclusively with Ulta Beauty at the start, that really changed the game.
But talk numbers to me. You know, when you say they wanted to put us on every door on day one, what does that actually mean? How much product did you have to suddenly come up with? What's the scale that we're talking about here?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask these numbers questions. That is part of what Michal was in charge of. But so it was 1,200 doors, and it would have been, you know, at least 100 or so unit per door. So if we did the maths, it was quite a lot. Luckily, I think we realised that our market was going to be in America. We had already, I think by that point, our first batches were made in the UK up north. But as soon as we realised that the US was going to be opportunity, Michal luckily had again a good contact with the manufacturer there, and we switched operations quite quickly.
Michal, you say, is the numbers guy, but let's talk some numbers anyway, because Piper has identified these, what they call key inflection points, which they've identified as 7, 17, 17. Now, whether that is, you know, number of employees or turnover or number of sites or whatever, where a business really has to change and adapt, the inflection point. So, first of all, does that chime with you?
It does. I think what's funny is it takes so long to get to that first, not even first 7 million, that first 1 million is the hardest one. We can remember up to the first million really clearly, and probably up to the first 7. But beyond that, up to, you know, where we got to in the end when we exited, you know, closer to 40, that is more of a blur. It's the early stage that we really kind of remember, the grinding part that you have to really kind of push for. So in terms of those numbers, yeah, when we exited, we were sort of halfway to the 70. Our team was always very lean, actually. So when we exited, we had about, I think it was probably about 15 in our team. And I know, having spoken to other founders, that that's really lean for a business of our scale. I think we always punched above our weight, and people were quite surprised about that. But, you know, we're proud of it. We had a great team, really hardworking team, really efficient.
Talk to me about the speed of growth, because what is so notable about your story is that the speed, the way it accelerated so quickly, and it just took off.
Yeah. You know, it was very fashionable at the time to be purely e-commerce, and that's what we thought we'd be. We thought we'd be a D2C brand, and we started that way, and that was a very kind of, it felt like quite slow growth. But as soon as we went into retail, that was the moment when it kind of exploded, really. We were always ambitious and we were always brave, I guess, in the way that, you know, we wouldn't turn down an opportunity. You know, they would say, can you be in every single door in X date? And we would say yes without thinking of it, and we would find a way to make it happen. And that's what Michał is so brilliant at, you know. His background wasn't operations, but actually he's a brilliant operator and he does get things done and he will work tirelessly to get things done. So there was no way that wasn't happening, you know, but however much work it took.
But it can't have been easy.
No, nothing. None of it was easy. No, especially in the early days, especially with very little resource. You know, it was just kind of him and half of me, and for quite a few years until we had our first employee. Quite a few years in, I think we made life hard for ourselves, and very little funding as well. I mean, of course, we did try to get funding, but it was hard in the early stages.
And talk to me more about this decision to go into the US via. I mean, it's a big group of stores. If anyone doesn't know, Ulta is huge, isn't it, in the United States? What about that point where you decided that was going to be the direction of travel?
I'm not sure whether we decided or whether it was decided for us. I mean, I think we quickly realised that we had a very limited resource. There was me and half of me, because I was still having to freelance to pay the bills, and Michał, and we didn't have anyone else. So we could, you know, it would take the same amount of time and effort and energy to service, let's say, one individual salon versus one buyer who was responsible for a whole bunch of stores. So it was almost like an efficiency need that forced us to, not forced, that led us down that route of kind of going big or going bust, really.
Mm. Did you see it as a massive opportunity?
We did. I don't think we knew how big it was going to be. And, you know, we also know from, you know, Michał's background working for other beauty brands is, you know, you might get listed in a retailer, but it's such a cutthroat environment and that competition for shelf space is intense. And, you know, even, you know, big brands, celebrity brands were in and out, and they would be delisted if they didn't sell. So we knew it wasn't a guarantee because, you know, they'd give us a try. We only had four products at that time for a line, a very small line. And they were just kind of giving us a bash, really. Mm. And they had no idea how big it was going to be, and neither did we. Mm. And we ended up by the time we exited, being the number one textured brand at Ulta with the biggest shelf space, compared to some very kind of big and not independent brands. So I think it was a surprise. We're grateful, obviously, to them for giving us a try. And I don't think we or them knew how successful that partnership was going to be.
And it can't have been easy to get into other retailers after that. I mean, you were exclusively with Ulta?
No, we were exclusive with Ulta for quite a few years. And I think that really served us well. I know brands can be nervous of that, but if you do sign that exclusivity agreement, they really will support you and grow you. And you can be focused as well, especially with our limited resources, we could then focus on that. Mm. And, you know, towards the end, that expired and we are now in Sephora and, you know, Feel Unique and lots of online retailers as well. So, we've expanded now in terms of our reach.
And what were the challenges of dealing in the US market?
Well, it depends if you mean, I think there's a big cultural difference between Americans and Brits. And I'd learned that, you know, from working with American clients in my consulting days as well. You know, it's our natural instinct to be quite self-deprecating as Brits. And I still find it quite uncomfortable to, you know, toot my own horn or whatever. But in America, that doesn't wash. You know, you really have to, like, be your own hype girl. I think that's where it's useful to have a partner as well, because you can hype each other a bit. I think one of the brilliant things that we loved is Americans are so open to outsiders and to people from all different cultures. You know, who's this, you know, funny British white girl and this guy with this foreign accent? Husband's Polish. And he doesn't mind me saying, you know, he describes his accent as his Dracula accent. And he's brilliant. He's so funny. He's brilliant. But I think, you know, Americans are so used to that kind of multicultural landscape. And you do feel like, you know, as a business person, you're really taking on your own merit, and the opportunities are huge. And, you know, people in business are so open-minded that was really, really refreshing and really encouraging. So we felt like even though there was geographical barriers and cultural barriers and even financial barriers, you know, figuring out the American tax system and incorporating a business over there, it's all difficult, and it can put a lot of people off. But actually, the sort of more important barriers are not there necessarily. Mm. There are obviously operational issues. I think to be in the US, it's such a huge market, you really do need to be cost efficient to manufacture there. So if anyone's thinking of launching in the US, I think it's worth looking into manufacturing facilities, distribution facilities over there. That makes a huge difference.
What about e-commerce and, you know, alongside that?
Yeah, we were always actively an e-commerce brand. And I think over time, the balance shifted and, you know, a greater proportion of our revenue came through e-commerce, through our own website, through, you know, beauty retail sites like Feel Unique and that kind of Look Fantastic, that kind of thing. And we did invest more and more as we grew the team. You know, we knew that there was a gap for, you know, e-commerce team. So, you know, we then had a group of people who purely focused on direct to consumer. So we're able to kind of build both sides of the business and be, because I think you need both to be truly sustainable. You can't just have all your eggs in one basket. In terms of brand discovery, retail is excellent, because the first thing someone does when you hand them a hair product is open it and smell it and look at it. It's quite a tactile experience, and you don't get all of that through online, although we worked really hard to kind of bring to life the texture of the product and how you used it and how it looked and that kind of thing.
Did you have to back it up with a big marketing drive?
At the beginning, we didn't have a lot of budget, so we had to be quite scrappy. Luckily, we launched during the days when organic growth was possible on social media. So before the iOS changes, you know, you could put something out on Instagram and people would see it. So we were really lucky, and we did a lot of work with influencers, and we kind of turned our community into influencers as well. You know, I think all of the early orders that we sent out had a little card in saying, please take a selfie with Curl Smith and, you know, tag us and that kind of thing. And people really would do it, and they spread the word for us. So we were lucky to get a lot of kind of free ambassadorship.
Because you didn't have the budget to do a big marketing campaign.
And we were cheeky as well. You know, we would rather ask for forgiveness than permission. You know, I remember I went out to the States at the beginning when we just launched, and I would literally stand in the Ulta store. And the Ulta store managers were brilliant. They were so open to any kind of, you know, guerrilla marketing. You know, I'd stand in the doorway and collar anyone who had curly or wavy hair and have a chat to them and, you know, funnel them towards our products and that kind of thing. So, you know, stand in the car park handing out flyers. I'm sure that was, you know, quite naughty. But, you know, we would do anything that, you know, we had to get creative because we didn't have the budget. Because I remember meeting in the early days, for example, a couple of buyers in the UK, and they just looked at us like, what, curly hair? That doesn't seem like a thing that anyone really needs. You know, we really, you know, in the early days, trying to get investment and really trying to convince people that this is a category worth investing in. This is a valuable and growing and exciting category just there for the taking. And honestly, most of the job in those early pitches was trying to persuade people that this wasn't a niche, that this was a really important category and it was going to become more important. And of course, it has done. But in the US, that category of curly and wavy hair was already there. It was already established. So it was, the barriers were lower.
Why do you think no one had really, or so few brands had actually gone into that space?
I really don't know. I think there's also this, you know, I think you said earlier, you know, did they think curly hair was difficult? And I think, you know, even people who have curly hair think it's difficult. You know, we'd have so many customer service. When I was doing customer service, most of it was just, oh, help me, I've got really bad hair. Even in hairdressing, up until really recently, hairdressers in the UK were not naturally, or automatically, I should say, trained in curly hair, in cutting curly hair. And it's a very different thing. I mean, any curly hair listeners will know that you can't just rock up to any old hairdresser and expect them to understand your hair type and how to cut it and the techniques. And there are very few specialist curly hairdressers in the UK and in the US. So it's treated as this other, but actually it's not. Like, most of us have some kind of hair texture that we're not, you know, treating to its full potential, really.
Do you have curly hair? I'm trying to
look. I don't have curly hair. I've had more of a wave. My husband has, you know, curlier hair. And actually, much to my dismay, I don't think he cut it from the day he started the business till the day after we sold it. So he grew this kind of Fabio-esque mane of curls because he insists, of course, on trying every single sample and every single product that he made. So he had this, you know, huge mane of hair for most of the time, which was quite amusing. But yeah, of course, it's so important. I mean, every day from the day we started it, there was something new to try in the shower. And whether or not it was suitable for my specific hair type, I would give it a go.
And what about the brand identity? Did you have from the beginning a clear view of what you wanted to be?
I think who and why was clear. I think what we wanted to look like was a bit different. So we, from the get-go, had this real drive to sort of help with curl confidence. And what we meant by that purpose of curl confidence is empowering everybody to love the hair they have. Most people don't, which is sad. Empowering everybody to love the hair they have, with the right kind of curl care, with products that really work, that give you really good results, but don't compromise on the health and quality of your hair, that don't have all those nasty ingredients that can dry your hair out and make it frizzy or unhealthy. So, and also, you know, a big part of curl confidence wasn't just making the right products and putting them on the shelf. It was increasingly, we realised, about education. So, and in the DNA of our brand was education, was, you know, not just making the right products, but showing people how to use them, how to get the most out of their specific hair type, even how to find out what the hair type is. I mean, there's many different hair types within the spectrum of curly hair, you know, all the way from 2A to 4C.
2A, 4C, what's
yeah,
that?
So there's like basically a categorization or coding of different hair types within textured hair. And it goes from 2, which is, you know, a little bit of a wave, to 4C, which would be kind of your afro type of hair. And all of those different hair types have quite different and specific needs. So you need to make sure initially you know what your hair type is, which is why a lot of the customers came to Curlsmith through our curl quiz. So if you go on to curlsmith.com, still now, you can do the curl quiz, find out what is your hair type for a start, and then have a tailored, personalised regime recommended to you. And then, you know, making sure you're using them properly. Because, again, when I was on customer service, half of the complaints, apart from operational issues, were, oh, it's not working for me. And then the next question obviously was, what products are you using? How it taught me through how you're using them. And 9 times out of 10, they weren't using them in the way that would get the best results. So we were able to kind of do a bit of education and help them get the most out of it. And often we'd hear back and say, oh, it did actually really work for me. Thank you for that. So more and more, the content that we put out there was not just, here's a new product, buy it, but here's the technique. If you've got this hair type, here's the technique to get this kind of result. And we worked heavily with influencers from the start to create content that was really helpful, basically. So I think at the core of our brand, we're helpful and helping people get the most out of their hair.
And that was kind of where you started anyway, because it was an online kind of forum and you were helping people even before you had products.
Yeah, even before that, we were trying to help. We didn't have much of an agenda at the start. We were just trying to help people who were looking for support and advice and, you know, tips and tricks or whatever about dealing with their hair.
And what is a curl friend?
A curl friend. That's kind of what we call our customers, our audience. We're a really community-oriented brand. So we, for example, we never intended to be the faces of our brand. We always wanted our community to be. And from the start, we intended to co-create the brand. So everything about Curlsmith was co-created with our community. You know, we'd have workshops and groups and we'd stop people on the street, and anybody and everybody we could find who had any kind of hair texture, we would kind of drag them in and get them involved. And they helped us design everything from the initial lineup to the ingredients to the benefits, even to the brand name. So we, our sort of company name, registered company name, is different from our brand name.
It was something about recipes.
Recipe Products Limited is we intended to launch the brand Recipe. And, you know, that was because we intended to kind of bottle these homemade hair remedies and make it really convenient and effective to use at home. So it was Recipe. And on the front of the pack, you know, you see literally the ingredients list, mm-hmm. literally the recipe. Mm. But we put it out to vote to our community very, very close to the launch, just before we were going to roll presses on the labels. And they voted for Curlsmith. That was just one of the options of about 10 we had. And I'm really glad they did, because I think you can't beat being clear and straightforward. Mm. You know, it does what it says on the tin. It tells you who this is for. It's for curls. It crafts curls. It looks like a craft brand. And yeah, I think that really helped us get to our audience more quickly, because it was so clear what we were all about. It can be a bit scary to be so defined about who you're going after. But I think if you target narrow, you will catch wide. So, yeah, we were always community driven. I think what was great about that is we'd involved so many experts, influencers, you know, members of the curly community in the creation of our product, that by the time we launched it, they already felt invested in the brand. They would be able to say, here's a new line from Curlsmith, and I helped create this. I helped, you know, decide what was in this. So it was created like for and by curly girls.
So everyone in a sense was an influencer.
Yeah, exactly.
All of your customers.
Yeah, and we did. We always featured a lot of sort of user-generated content. Many of the models that we use in our communications were just customers who, you know, had amazing hair and were able to show amazing results with Curlsmith. So we were often kind of making people's day by inviting them to be involved in a campaign or be on a poster in Ulta or something like that.
So the tone of voice, I'm thinking, I'm guessing very much, is a positivity, an inclusivity.
Yeah. Definitely inclusive. I think some brands were focusing on a very specific part of that market and alienating others. And we were always inclusive, even down to the, you know, the branding is very unusual for, in terms of the look and feel, is quite unusual in that space. And it deliberately doesn't have, you know, a woman on the front. I think as soon as you've got a face on the front of a pack, you're going to put off anyone who doesn't relate to that kind of identity. So we were careful to not exclude any kind of hair type or gender. We were very inclusive and straightforward as well. I think it can be really confusing and complicated, the world of curly hair, because it is so different to sort of straight hair and the mainstream. So, yeah, a lot of people would come to us very confused. I don't know what my hair type is. I don't know what to use. I don't know how to use it. And we were able to, guide people to the right kind of way to take care of their hair. And I think in so doing, we almost ended up attracting a lot of people who were very new to the market. We almost kind of grew the category. We weren't attracting so much of the, you know, curly hair experts, but, you know, people who were like, oh, I've got a feeling there's something going on with my hair. I've kind of got frizzy hair. I think I might have wavy or curly hair, but I don't know how to kind of bring that out or enhance my natural hair texture. So we were able to sort of guide people to the right products, the right techniques to kind of really discover their hair and how beautiful it really was for the first time. And that was so rewarding.
How difficult was it to actually develop the products? Because you've said, you know, that they just didn't really exist. And your husband had contacts with manufacturers and so on, producers. But how did you specifically decide what the products would be?
One thing we realised really quickly is this isn't skincare. It isn't hope in a jar. Your customers will know instantly if your product is working for them or not, and they will be very vocal about it. So, you know, we knew that this stuff had to work first and foremost. It didn't matter that we could put the most beautiful natural ingredients in. It had to work, had to give them results or they wouldn't be happy and they wouldn't come back. So we were always obsessed by formulas, and it was a very iterative process to develop the formulas. We had, you know, 20, 30 iterations of a formula often, and we'd kind of test it, send it out to our panel of curl friends. They would give their feedback. We'd change things. And it was kind of painful, but it was worth doing because we ended up with a set of products that were very effective. The initial lineup, I think it was very different for anyone who has straight hair. The products are very different. So we had a co-wash, which is basically a kind of conditioning wash, a bit like a two-in-one shampoo conditioner, but more swayed towards conditioner because curly hair it needs more moisture. It tends to be drier, more porous. So we had a co-wash, and I think we had a conditioning product, two styling products. So it's a lot more, curly hair care is a lot more about styling and a lot less about kind of shampooing.
How important was the African, Caribbean community to that? You know, because you talked about how this was already a more developed area in the United States, and that I'm guessing is because of that community being larger there. So how important, what was the relationship that you forged?
Well, we never set out to target any particular ethnic group. So when I say 70-80% of women have textured hair, that's everybody. We never targeted any specific ethnic group. And in so doing, we became really inclusive. So I think when I last saw the data, I think it was about 50% of our audience were people of colour and 50% were Caucasian. So very inclusive. And our influencers and our audience were, you know, had every different kind of hair type and every different kind of ethnicity. So everyone was important and everyone was invited.
You're listening to the Piper podcast, How I Grew My Brand. I'm talking to co-founder of Curlsmith, Kate Bursky. How different are your products, actually? What is what you call clean curl care?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think I've tried a lot of hair products in my time. We all have. And I kind of put them in a few different categories. And it tends to be, you know, if you want to go out and find a natural product, so a non-toxic, you know, no nasty chemicals kind of product, there are so many of them that you try it and your hair ends up that kind of squeaky dry feeling. So you've compromised on the results for the kind of integrity of the product. And then you've got the kind of salon products, which, you know, feel very nice to use, very glossy. They usually smell very nice. And you'll think, oh, this is great. I'm loving this. And then you'll look on the bottle and it will be, you know, silicones, sulfates, parabens, phthalates, DEAs, drying alcohols, stuff that makes your hair look great the first time you use it, but over time will kind of degrade the quality of your hair. So there was a compromise. So either you're compromising on results or on ingredients. And then the other compromise is about, you know, the focus of the brand. So lots of brands, particularly now, have realised there's an opportunity to you know, take care of textured hair. So they've launched a curly hair line with very little real understanding of what curly hair would need in terms of the makeup of the line, in terms of the ingredients and the performance of the products. So you're either compromising on, you know, a brand that doesn't specialise in curls, so doesn't really understand you, or a brand that performs well but isn't actually that good for your hair, or a brand that's pretty good for your hair but your hair's not going to look that good. Mm. So we were obsessive about creating a line of products which didn't have any compromise.
Which is clean. It's one of those buzzwords, though, isn't it? Clean.
Yeah, we don't
like
really like it.
Clean eating or clean, you know, it's
a... Yeah, and I think, you know, that there is a lot of, there is a bit of clean washing, isn't there? And there is definitely a place in cosmetics for kind of those safe synthetics. I mean, some natural ingredients are actually quite harsh. So, you know, you need to get the balance right.
Because right from the beginning, you were very clear on your environmental credentials, weren't you?
Yeah, we were always vegan, cruelty-free, no sort of damaging ingredients, and using lots of, you know, natural and nourishing ingredients. So that's where kind of the hair recipes came in. And then towards the end, you know, when we had a bigger team and a little bit of a bigger budget, we had the luxury of being able to invest in some more kind of environmental, social, community initiatives as well. Piper is a B Corp, which, you know, really draws me to any business that's a B Corp, because I believe in it so much. And we were on the journey to becoming B Corp. So hopefully that will happen. And we also started working with hygiene poverty charities. So in the States, there's a project called Project Beauty Share. And over here, it's called Hygiene Bank. And one thing that we became aware of over time is there are, you know, food banks and things like that, especially in, you know, times of financial crisis. But they don't give out personal care products, so feminine hygiene, shampoos, conditioners, that kind of thing. So there's a bit of a gap there. People still do need those personal care products. So organisations like the Hygiene Bank, Project Beauty Share, give away, you know, beauty products, personal care products to low-income families and individuals, helping them with, you know, getting into interviews and that kind of thing, and supporting them. So that was really nice that we were able to then kind of invest back a little bit into the community at the end.
I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship between you and Michal and building that up and working together. There must have been challenges of living with this 100% of the time.
Yeah, I think it can become a bit all work and no play, to be honest. And it was very intense, you know. You know, particularly, you know, he did work incredibly hard. It was 7 days a week for quite a few years. And, you know, obviously then when we introduced a baby into the mix, that became even more challenging a few years down the line.
And then COVID happened.
And then COVID, you know, we had it all. Although COVID was relatively good for us, actually. We sort of thrived through COVID. We were one of those sort of fortunate businesses that were able to kind of grow. But yeah, you know, pros and cons of working with your partner. But I think we were always, you know, like I said, very clear on our roles and responsibilities. And, you know, it's quite an unpopular opinion, but we kind of don't really believe in democracy in a small business. I think you need to have someone who is really taking the big decisions, because you need to move quickly. We were moving really quickly. Mm. So while we, you know, over the years did build up a really strong team, you know, he was still in charge and I never tried to sort of override. We weren't kind of, he was the CEO. And I was, you know, more of a team member, really.
So you always knew exactly how the roles were divided. There was never any question about that.
No, there was never any question. You know, he's a, like I said, a born leader. I'm more of a born team member. So it worked out well. His role was very consistent throughout the business, but my role changed over time depending on our personal circumstances, basically. So at the beginning, you know, freelancing to support us, and then later on taking on the bulk of childcare so he could continue pushing the business forward.
Mm. And so that's how it works, is that you did and still do the majority of the childcare?
Well, now we're able to be a bit more equal because we've been out of the business for a year. But, yeah, you know, we had to at a certain point take the decision that he would have to focus on continuing to grow the business and I'd have to focus on taking care of our baby.
Particularly with COVID, and
there
was
no
childcare. No, and your parent, you've moved now to live closer to your parents, haven't you? But how did you do all that? You know, how did you take care of your mental health, I suppose? Because as an entrepreneur, you've got to be relentlessly positive, haven't you? You've got to get out there and sell it.
Yeah. So we went into Ulta in 2018. My daughter was born in 2019. So we were kind of establishing, but that was the point where the business was really blowing up. We really couldn't take our foot off the pedal. And then we had my daughter. And then lockdown happened. So I think that year was probably the most difficult year. You know, really, we were kind of in our own, in many ways, in our own lanes. So, you know, he was fully in the business and I was fully in this with this new baby. And there wasn't a lot. That was when we kind of weren't as connected as a business team. And so that must have been really hard for him kind of doing it on his own. At that point, we still only had one other team member servicing this massive retail client with kind of two of them and me whenever I could in between feeding the baby, you know, doing a bit of social media or a bit of customer service. Yeah, I mean, I remember being hours after giving birth and, you know, being on our Instagram account trying to reply to customers and thinking, this is not right. Like this, if I had a real job, I'd be, you know, having a bit of maternity leave now. So there wasn't balance for quite a few years. Mm. And it's not popular to say it, but, you know, that felt like the only way we could kind of make it happen. I think now we learned so many lessons from that, though obviously we survived and thrived and lived to tell the tale, but I don't think we would do any of it in quite the same way again.
What would you do differently?
We would grow the team much more quickly, much earlier. So I think we were so obsessed with bootstrapping and the lean startup and never wasting a penny, you know, and that's how we survived, you know, day to day. You know, that's why the business didn't die, because we were so careful with money. But at the same time, I really think when we did start to grow, we should have brought in some more heavy lifters more quickly, particularly when I was going to have to step away from the business to, you know, have a baby and that kind of thing. Yeah, I think in hindsight, we would probably have a team from the outset and not try and do quite so much on our own.
What were the key appointments when you did make them, do you think?
I think a big game changer for us was Jennifer Moran. She was our president of North America. So she was, you know, till the end, probably our only fully US-based employee, which is quite funny for a US-oriented business. She was a brilliant hire because we knew her because she was a buyer at Ulta Beauty formerly. And so Michal had kept in touch with her and had a conversation with her and kind of very cheekily kind of said, what about, would you like to come on board? You know, she'd left Ulta at that point. And that was great because she was able to help us really navigate through the kind of confusing and scary sometimes waters of those contracts and that whole relationship. So she was brilliant. And, you know, when we stepped down, she took over as CEO as well.
Okay, so you knew you were leaving it in capable hands, which is rather wonderful.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, as a founder, you are constantly, aren't you, having to kind of break new ground. You have to do everything, I'm guessing, sometimes well outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, I mean, there is nobody coming to save you. There is nobody coming to help you. You can't afford to buy in help and, you know, that kind of thing at the start. So if you want something done, you just have to figure out a way. You know, there was a lot of YouTube tutorials, how on earth do we edit videos, and just kind of turning up to things and just hoping for the best. And of course, we had some false starts and some bad meetings and some things that didn't go quite so well in the beginning. But I mean, Michal's incredibly resourceful. The things that man can do is really quite impressive. I think, you know, when you have a child and you're really tired, or you've got several children and people say, I don't know how you do it. Well, you have no choice. It's the same with a business. We knew we were not going to give up. You can quit tomorrow, but today we give it absolutely everything. And then, of course, you get up the next day, you do it all again.
And you do it all again. There was something, I was obviously doing a bit of reading up about you before this. There was something that you said Michal had told you and you discussed, which really struck me, is that when you're, you know, you're out selling or you're trying to, you know, persuade someone to take your product, no doesn't necessarily mean no. It just means, it might mean not now.
I definitely learned that from him and through the business because, you know, at the start, when you're trying to persuade a retailer to stock you, or you're trying to persuade, encourage an investor to come on board, or even to hire someone who's never heard of this small kind of two-bit brand, whatever it is, you hear a lot of no. And you do, when it is your business and it is your baby, you do take it quite personally. And it is personal. You know, we would sit in investor meetings and they would say, we invest in people and we don't like you. So it doesn't get more personal than that. You know, I think there was a few moments where Michal had to pick me up off the floor, being, you know, the sensitive one. But, you know, so we heard a lot of no's, and, you know, we had conversations with retailers at the start where they said, no, it's not for us. And, you know, it would be tempting to think, well, that's a closed door then. We've tried that, tick it off the list and try the next one. But what I realised over time is, as our business changed and grew and got more traction, those conversations weren't closed. So there were investors that, you know, came back on board later down the line, and there were retailers that then ended up stocking us who'd previously rejected us, for example. And, yeah, so I think, you know, I would encourage anyone to kind of not take those rejections as outright rejections. It's just kind of a not now. I mean, you can have, even a whole business can be a brilliant idea, but just at the wrong time. And, you know, lots of things changed, you know, culturally and in the environment over the time we ran the business, which were fortunate for us as well. You know, there's a lot of hard work, but there's also a lot of sort of luck as well and timing benefits.
Was there ever a point where you thought, ha, we've got this. This is great.
I think we were too busy to ever think that. I think one of the things that we never did, which we probably should have more, is celebrate the small wins or the wins along the way. I think we were just so focused on, okay, that thing's done, on to the next, that we never really, I don't think we ever rested on our laurels. Not even now. Even now when we have sold the business, we have exited, and it was successful when we exited. Still, we kind of have these nightmares of like, oh, but what, something could go wrong, you know. It's you're always just waiting for something to go wrong, I think. It sounds terrible, but it's peppered, having a startup, starting a business is peppered with landmines. You know, things come out of left field all the time that you just can't foresee. Legislation can change. I mean, there's, you know, there's lots of different rules and regulations in the US about what you can put in products, and that would be changed, and you would have to overnight reformulate every single thing in your line, and at huge expense and difficulty. So even if you're doing everything right, things just come at you.
Out of your control.
And we saw businesses bigger than us fail in the time. So, you know, you never really rest on your laurels, I don't think.
So wind forward then to last year. What about the decision to sell? How did that come about?
As soon as you get sort of big investors, VCs involved, you know, you literally have to write into your business plan your exit strategy. So that the plan is that they will invest on the premise that you exit. I mean, I think we felt that we'd taken it as far as we wanted to, and that we were ready to have a new challenge, focus on a new category. But the decision to sell and actually selling are two very different things. I mean, the process is not guaranteed. Plenty of brands are on the market for years and they don't sell. And it's quite a complicated and stressful process in itself. So it's not like we decided to sell and next day that was it. It was it took a year or so, I think, from the decision of, I think it's about time, to the time that we actually exited.
And you were in agreement, were you?
Yeah.
There was never any question.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we started the business, we didn't have a family. We had much sort of simpler lives, and we could work in that crazy intense way. And we both craved more balance. And we just felt it was time to kind of step away, spend some time together as a family while my daughter was still young.
But as you say, it's not simple selling, is
no.
it? It takes time. And was that a stressful process in itself?
Yeah, it was like an additional job. I think when you grow really quickly like we did and you start quite small, you don't think, or you don't have time to have all of the kind of processes and paperwork and policies and everything all lined up neatly and everything, you know, signed off from 5 years ago. So there was a lot of work behind the scenes to kind of gather together all the materials and the evidence to make sure we were handing over the business in the best possible shape. I think because we'd grown so fast, we didn't have all that stuff in place. And again, that's another thing that we'd know for next time, that we'd have a lot of things set up from the get-go that would make it kind of a cleaner proposition. Until it was signed off, we never really believed it was true.
And then it happened and you got sick. I know, both of you didn't. You went to bed for about a month.
We got so ill. I think it was just that big release. You know, you don't allow yourself to be ill when you're so busy. And then it just, I think people have that in holidays sometimes, don't they?
Did you feel any grief? Any sense of loss at having sold your baby?
Yeah, it's funny because by that point I'd kind of transferred those emotions onto my real life baby. So probably it was easy for me. But yeah, I was still sad. You know, it felt very abrupt. I think I would have loved to have, you know, properly, because most of our team didn't know. You know, our senior leadership team were part of the process to sell the business, but the rest of our team didn't know. And that felt strange. I did feel like I would have liked to have a few more conversations and just make sure everyone was okay. But we kind of just had to kind of close our laptops and walk away.
Wow. Did you pop the champagne? Did you?
We thought we would. We still have a bottle of champagne on ice for a year that we were supposed to pop when we sold. It didn't feel, you know, people always imagine it's like woohoo, champagne, jumping on a yacht, but it doesn't feel that way because your whole purpose in life is suddenly gone.
Do you miss it?
We miss what it gave us in terms of purpose and drive, but we've got other projects kind of going on and we're no longer in control of it. So I try not to look at much. Obviously it pops up and people mention things and things come up on Instagram. And I think, oh, they're doing such a good job. I'm so proud of them. I think it's in really good hands in the team and with Helen of Troy. So I think it will thrive. But at the same time, I try not to look at too much because it would drive me mad because I might have other ideas about how things should be done or whatever. So yeah,
so
I
try you're trying to not to stalk myself. Your ex.
I try not to, yeah, stalk my ex, yeah.
Do you have any regrets? Any advice?
I think we made life harder for ourselves than it needed to be by not getting the support that we needed at the right times. So we should have got more money more quickly. We should have got a bigger team more quickly. And we should have sought the kind of softer external support, because it can feel quite lonely and people don't understand. You know, people would say, well, if it's this hard, you know, if he's not making any money, why is he doing it or whatever? But you have to kind of keep the faith. And so it's good to be surrounded by people who really understand what it is and what you're trying to do, and that it isn't going to be an overnight success. You know, it doesn't feel that way at the time.
Are you going to go again?
Yeah, we'll go again. We've got too many ideas. We've got too much energy not to. And we'll probably do it together. I won't, you know. Yeah, we will. We don't know what or when, but we've already got a lot of ideas and obviously a lot of opportunities coming to us. So it's exciting. It's a really exciting time, actually.
Well, come back and tell us all about it
when you will.
when you have the next one.
Will do.
Kate Bursky, it's lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much.